The New Statesman podcast is sponsored by Uber. It's coming up to 3 years since Uber and the GMB union signed a landmark recognition agreement, the first of its kind in the gig economy.
Having that recognition with GMB union shows that Uber's serious about drivers' protection.
Ali Haydor drives with Uber and he works as a representative for the GMB union.
The workers contract what the drivers have got is thanks to GMB. They're getting sick pay, national living wage, holiday pension. They're also able to choose the hours they want to work and the days they want to work. Also, they get to choose the jobs they want to do. Now, that is a proper work-life balance. It's full flexibility at the same time as good standard of wage there.
A wide range of issues come from all over the country from our members, and we'll take these issues to the company, discuss with the management, and the team will actually accommodate that. Now, you couldn't get that kind of access on a collective voice if you didn't have the recognition agreement.
Find out more by listening to our special episode titled Reshaping the Gig Economy. Find it in the New Statesman podcast feed now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to this week's New Statesman podcast. I'm Patrick McGuire, and this week I'm joined by my colleagues Stephen Bush, Anoush Chikelian, and Alva Ray to discuss: what does a leaked report into factionalism at Labour Party HQ mean for Keir Starmer? And you ask us what we're reading and what we're not during lockdown.
So one of the big stories over the bank holiday weekend was a leaked internal Labour Party report that claims factionalism in the party machine hindered Jeremy Corbyn and that leadership's ability to tackle anti-Semitism at the party, and also tried to obstruct the party's electoral performance in 2017. Now, this is an 860-page document, and while it's been confirmed that it is a genuine draft document, it's unclear who actually commissioned it, who it was written by, what it was for. Sky reported that party lawyers have said that they wouldn't be submitting it to the Equality and Human Rights Commission, which is, of course, investigating anti-Semitism in the Labour Party at the moment. But we don't even know if it was for that purpose either. So what were your first thoughts when you had sight of the report in the journalistic parlance, Stephen?
I mean, obviously, my first thought was, oh God, could this not have happened at a time when I was having to spend 2 days reading this on, you know, on NS time, not Stephen Bush time? But well, I think so. So, yeah, with the caveat that I have only been able to read it once, and therefore I may have missed something. I think, you know, so the report itself actually doesn't go as far as to go, and this was deliberate, or kind of anti-Corbyn elements within the party headquarters actively tried to prevent him winning the 2017 election. That is a conclusion that is being made for it rather than in the report itself. But it essentially is a kind of a report prepared for reasons unknown, which in of itself has triggered another report, independent investigation that will be commissioned but not run by the new leader and deputy leader, which will cover three things. One, the specific allegations about the party and how it operates in the report, which include a variety of reported to be statements that are not, yeah, they very much are not in accordance with the values and aims of the party and are not professional. So there's kind of that pillar. Pillar two is, you know, the circumstances of its commissioning, who it was written by. Among other things, the report does not redact the personal details of the people who made complaints, and the leaking, which has compounded that problem of them not being made private, because those things are now sort of semi-freely circulating online. Although I would imagine that the legal processes around information protection will take care of that aspect fairly swiftly. So I guess my kind of main thinking about it, and the annoying thing is whenever I get a document of any length, you prefer to be able to read it cold rather than this situation having had it leaked to you in a kind of like, well, seeing as everyone else has got it kind of way.
Yeah.
Which meant then I didn't come to it sort of, you know, in a kind of like, what's it? But I broadly think that Adam Wanger, the lawyer, suggesting it may actually have been planned as an EHRC submission because it has a structure like that and does very much speak to some of the terms. The report sort of explicitly tries to do one thing, which is broadly to say that from 2015 to 2017, when the party headquarters was still in the hold of Corbyn skeptics, in which, the kind of majority of people, I think it's fair to say you describe them as kind of right Brownites, so people whose first preference in 2010 was to vote for Ed Balls, whose second preference was to vote for David Miliband, and whose very, very, very distant third and fourth preference was for Andy Burnham and Ed Miliband, and who, very pointedly would have put a fifth place point by Diane Abbott. So very much that was the sort of politics of the office in 2015. And the argument that the report sort of seeks to make is, look, the central problem here was factionalism in the office and, intense opposition to the leader made us dysfunctional for the first 2 years. But when Jenny Formby became General Secretary of the Labour Party, things vastly improved. And I think it does a much better job of, obviously its content is fiercely contended and will, of course, all be probed by this second independent report. I think it does a much stronger job of proving, it does a much stronger job of advancing the first point than it does the 2018, the problem after then was just dysfunctionality case, not least, in many ways, right, the problem the report has with advancing that argument is the very existence of an unredacted report in which the party marks its own homework when the one specific and repeated demand of the various community organizations has been for the party to stop doing in its own sort of homework checking on this issue, underlines that it sort of fails to make that case for itself. But the kind of significant political thing, I think, is that it, in an odd way, right, in terms of those of us who have been kind of trying to work out who Keir Starmer is and what he's really about, in an odd way, right, I think what this report has done is it has semi-made that choice for him, right? So the question before Starmer was going to be, when you say you want to professionalise the party, do you mean genuine professionalism, kind of the party staff behaving, being perhaps more ecumenical, an end to the kind of culture of fix that was prevalent just after the 2019 intake about many of their selections, even in Corbyn's period of internal hegemony. Does he actually mean away with all that, or does he mean let's bring some old faces back, or let's do that, but do it with different people on the old levers? Now, I suspect, and of course all of this pens the genuinely independent inquiry into the report, but I suspect that one of the consequences of this report is it makes that decision for him, if that makes sense. And I guess that was my sort of overwhelming impression of it, right? Then partly because I had this slightly weird thing, and the second I finished reading it was the moment that the kind of press release about the independent inquiry came through. So it obviously slightly coloured my impression of it. But I kind of thought, in an odd way, the decision on this has Keir and Angela have made their decision on this, which is basically to go, we think we have a job of work cleaning up the institutions and practices. And then that problem does not just start in September 2015. But in an odd way, I think the significant thing is it kind of means that we won't ever fully be able to look back on the decisions they made in terms of personnel and go, that was what this project was really about, because I think some of those decisions have been taken out of his hands.
The point you make about party unity is interesting in how one defines it, because if we look from the other end of the telescope, there was a live question before this kicked off, which is, surely the left of the Labour Party, be they at the grassroots or in Parliament, are divided. They don't share a diagnosis of how the 29 leadership result happened. Indeed, some of them are quite happy about it, and they lacked a point of unity around which to coalesce. And if you look at the reaction from the campaign group and others on the left of the party, from Momentum and similar, it's clear that this has given them a lightning rod for discontent and a narrative that the left of the party hitherto lacked. And in a way, it has perversely empowered that wing of the party. So Keir Starmer is going to have to deal with that, and that further constrains, as you say, his capacity to reshape the party in his own image rather than genuinely seek to unite its vociferous coalition. He will, as you say, genuinely, circumstances have constrained his options there. So it's not a great inheritance for any leader. But conversely, surely if his intention was genuinely to do that, and there is a school of thought that says it was, such are his politics, then being seen not to bring back old faces, if the inquiry means he is unable to do that, is, you know, a cheap way of making political hay out of this, if that's not too crass a way of thinking about it. Because if his intention wasn't to reappoint old faces, well, if he's seen not to do that now, he might get more credit for doing so. I don't know.
Yeah, I think I was going to disagree with your conclusion slightly, and then I think actually that caveat is entirely the right one, right? Then if you take it as read, and this very much would be my diagnosis of the reshuffle and of, you know, the people he chose to promote versus and the people he chose not to promote, and the ways that as he did incorporate people from the right and left of the party, he largely has done it in a I'm aligned with so-and-so on X, and so they will be the minister for X kind of way. Now, I think in an odd way, yeah, as I repeatedly said about the sexual harassment stuff, which was, I think, when the kind of serious critical histories of the Corbyn era are written, the moment then people will go, this kind of shows it actually just wasn't fundamentally a serious project for power, will be the ostentatious refusal to sacrifice a few of their own people, not because their own people are more pure on the issue of sexual harassment, simply because they were in a smaller minority to begin with. So to be honest, even if they had been 100% in indices of it among them, they would have still been better off letting the kind of cleansing fire work its way through the party and choosing not to. And I kind of think in many ways, right, like professionalizing a political party is like that, right? Like even if at the end of it, you've lost some of your own allies directly, you're still in a stronger position anyway. Of course, the question is if what was actually meant by all of that was, you know, simply recreating the, you know, the kind of the 2015 structure, the sort of the school of Labour thought that I'm afraid I do sometimes slightly unflatteringly privately refer to as make Labour relevant losers again. Yeah, I think that this has closed that path, I suspect. However, if that's not the path Keir wants to go down, I think it actually gives him this sort of, I was about to say headwind, but I think that might be the reverse. Backwind, whatever it is, a headwind,
a tailwind.
I think it's a tailwind. It's given a tailwind to that, if that is who the real Starmer is.
Yeah, for instance, if he didn't want to appoint a certain person named in that report as General Secretary, he can now say, well, nobody named in that report is going to be my General Secretary, while knowing he wasn't going to do that anyway.
The New Statesman podcast is sponsored by Uber, who offer their drivers worker protections and a range of benefits, including access to fully funded undergraduate degree courses through the Open University.
It's like a dream that was something that was missing from myself.
Sanan Ahmed has been driving with Uber for 8 years.
I start driving with Uber because it provides flexibility. You can work whenever you want. I couldn't complete my studies before. I had a huge gap of almost 5 years. When I get into IT, I was working full-time with Uber, and they gave the opportunity, like, you can study while you work. With the Open University, it was the same thing. It's flexible. You can take your lectures whenever you're free. I've studied the bachelor's in business management, graduated last year. Currently, I'm doing my master's. That impact that Uber and Open University had on my future, I'm very positive. Now I've got goals that I've set for myself, and before there was no way I could achieve it. But now I feel like I'm in the right direction.
Find out more by listening to our special episode titled Reshaping the Gig Economy. Find it in the New Statesman podcast feed now.
And now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us. Oh, so the question, well, so actually I'm going to cheat and smush together two questions, which are, what are the podcasts and audiobooks and board games and video games are you enjoying during the lockdown? There's questions from sort of two and a bit people, and then some people have asked about two of those, some people have asked about one of those. But I just thought in general, a kind of the question is clearly like, what are we doing when we're not doing this in lockdown?
So I don't know if this counts as a board game, but About a year ago, we bought a foosball table, and not just a small plastic children's foosball table, but a proper wooden one that we found on Facebook Marketplace. And it's really nice. Like, it's got the little metal players. It's actually the French mold of foosball tables. So Babby Foot is the actual name of the game. And it's been a bit of an albatross since then, because it's absolutely huge and it just sits in the bedroom and gets in the way, and we just sort of like bruise ourselves while we're walking around it. But it has been an absolute godsend since this began, because all we do is just, you know, if we're bored or we want something to distract us or we can't think of anything else to do, we just we jouer au Babby Foot, and we're really, really good at it now. And I just, you know, I feel like I might be able to play competitively after this period. But it's also really nice, because it's something that I used to play, and there's a reason why I'm good at it, because I've got the muscle memory from when I used to play it as a child in Lebanon, because they have that sort of French legacy there, where a classic evening of drinking and entertainment is to play foosball. And I used to play it with my dad and his friends, and they had these classic wooden French tables as well. So it's a nice little memory as well.
Out of interest, why do you call it foosball? It's very.
I don't. I'm just trying to say it. I know. I'm trying to sort of say what most people understand it as from Friends, which I think is where most people know it from.
But, okay.
I don't actually call it that. I call it baby foot or table football.
I prefer baby foot. I'd forgotten that from my GCSE French.
That literally brings back traumatic memories of French exchanges. Being in pubs with Georges, having to play baby foot and being terrible at it.
Well, you better never face me in a game, Alva, because I am better than Georges.
What have you been up to, Stephen?
It's one of those weird things where I keep saying, oh, I'm dealing with it fine. And then I look at what I'm reading and it's just like, so clearly at some, like my current reading habits are clearly the sign of someone in like a deep level of emotional distress at some point. Because I've been rereading the collected comic strips from Doctor Who magazine from 1996 to 2005, the best era of Doctor Who, in which the show was, I got it, it was just such a hipster douchebag opinion to hold as well. I was going to say the best era of the show when it was off the air. You know, Paul McGann, who played it in actually a very good made-for-TV movie, was the canonical Doctor, but because his adventures were entirely seen off screen, you had kind of like comic book artists and radio producers doing very interesting things within that kind of universe. But of course, the main reason why I've been reading some of the old Eighth Doctor adventures. Of course, the main reason why I've been reading those is they remind me of a time in my sort of late childhood, early teens, when I was, you know, not locked up inside. I keep allegedly saying, and what I'm going to do is like read like Duck's Newburyport and The Mirror and the Light. I mean, The Mirror and the Light, which I consciously bought in a kind of, I'm going to be locked in my home soon, therefore I don't need to worry about carrying this on the tube, and I have not got around to it. I've really got into, yeah, another like trends from like the mid-noughties, the video game Life is Strange, which I strongly recommend to anyone. It's kind of choice-based, which means if, like me, you're deeply malcoordinated, you don't have to worry about like dying because you couldn't press X quickly in succession. It's a really interesting like slice of life video game, but that is essentially what I am doing, because yeah, I'm very much clearly not handling this weird period. Alva, what are you up to?
So in a way, I don't know which of the weird hobbies and interests I've taken up to mention, because there are honestly so many. But like you, I feel like I've been handling everything fine, and I actually do just mainly feel very lucky that I'm in a reasonably nice situation to handle this virus. But I did spontaneously order a keyboard to pick up the piano again, having not played since I left for university. So I've been like, I'm really, really bad. Anytime I've gone traveling or been staying with people and they have a piano, it always comes up that I can play. And they always think I'm being modest when I say I'm really bad, and then I start playing and I'm terrible. So I'm really trying to work on it. I'm trying to find an online teacher, because I'm really bad at, or like I'm very slow at reading the bass clef for my left hand. But that's the sort of the new hobby I'm trying to take up. Then also a very only child thing is that when I was growing up, my mum felt that it was very important for me to have a really good knowledge of old films. So a bit like you, Stephen, rewatching old films sort of takes me back to a nice point in childhood, but it's also a good education for my partner. So he had never seen Cinema Paradiso, which I think is the best film ever made. And we watched that together a few days ago. We've been watching lots and lots of old black and white Hollywood films. But Cinema Paradiso, which isn't a Hollywood one, is the one I would absolutely recommend to anyone who hasn't seen it. It's just about a little boy who helps the projectionist in a local cinema in Sicily, and about the sort of the life in the village there. And there's just, it's not really what it's about though. It's just the light and the warmth and the love of cinema and everything in it. It's just the most brilliant film ever. We've been watching that. I've also got a jigsaw on the go. I've got really into yoga and running a book club with my friends, did some baking. Yes. Yeah, handling it great.
Wow.
How wholesome.
Yeah.
I feel so lazy in comparison.
I suppose it's my turn. Very boring answer. I'm writing a book. I spend most of my free time doing that. When I'm not doing that, I don't know if it's the done thing to recommend podcasts on other podcasts, but I wait with bated breath all week for the new episode of a podcast called Quickly Kevin Will He Score to drop, which is a podcast about 90s football, which is very funny and good. If anyone listening to this podcast is in the middle of that particular Venn diagram, they sort of dredge up weird documentaries about 90s football and watch them and interview very notable and obscure figures. For instance, the latest episode is about Torquay United in the 90s, which is good value. But yeah, I mean, I've just got sort of like a graveyard of lockdown aspirations. I really wanted to rewatch a very slow and bucolic detective series from the 90s called Pie in the Sky, which the summer before I went to uni used to be on ITV3 all night, like back-to-back episodes. There are 40 episodes in total, I think. And I used to have this routine where I'd watch, I don't know if anyone remembers The Valleys, which was MTV's South Wales remake of Jersey / Geordie Shore. So that would be on at midnight. I'd watch The Valleys at midnight, and then Geordie Shore would be on at 1. And then I'd watch Pie in the Sky like 2 till 4. So it was like really like sublime to the ridiculous. Anyway, the premise of Pie in the Sky is Richard Griffiths is like this maverick genius detective, despite being, you know, morbidly obese. And his life's ambition is to retire to the countryside to run a restaurant called Pie in the Sky, which mainly specialised in pie. But on his last day, the police chief, who was so terrified of losing Richard Griffiths as his star detective, sort of staged an incident where Griffiths was sort of fingered for taking a bribe, even though that wasn't true. So he was sort of like, okay, you can retire on the basis that you work for me on a retainer. So, you know, every episode is like Richard Griffiths has mastered a new pie and he's just about to tuck into the pie or serve the pie. And his wife gets a phone call. It's like, you know, you're going to have to go and solve a crime. And he resents doing it so much, but he's so good at it. And it's a very pure and wholesome TV show, but I've not watched a single episode of it because I'm too busy pretending to work.
At least, Patrick, you'll be one of the very few people to have actually written a book in lockdown, the way probably so many people have hoped to do.
So I'm actually very bitter about this because before the lockdown, I was writing, and thankfully probably never going to inflict on the world, a truly terrible bit of derivative science fiction about, right, get this, it's about like a future London in which the air quality has got so bad and everyone has to stay inside. And so it's now gone from being a terrible derivative science fiction novel to a terrible derivative coronavirus novel. And so it's gone from being something which should definitely never be published to something which I'm now actively ashamed of, even though it's become so much worse as the result of this crisis.
I would honestly love to read that. I bet there'll be a publisher listening who want a piece of that.
Speaking of books, I mean, I've got a stack of unread books on my desk. I brought one of them back from London with me, which is Neville Shute's On the Beach, which is about a group of people in Australia who are waiting on the beach for the fallout of a nuclear explosion to kill them. It was the inspiration for Morrissey's hit single Every Day Is Like Sunday. Not read it. And then on top of that, I've got a volume of Pevsner's Buildings of England. Now, this is a sort of get your tiny violins out. I ordered Pevsner's volume on North Lancashire, which includes my native Southport, so I could get on my bike and look at every building that's mentioned in Pevsner on my downtime. And the Amazon seller sent me the wrong one. They sent me Manchester in the southeast of Lancashire. So I mean, I can just order another North Lancashire one, but that's going to take a long time. So that's, you know, that was a week of anticipation followed by disappointment, and I can't be bothered to go to the post office. Well, it's irresponsible to go to the post office to send it back, and I've got no way of getting to South East Lancashire. What a life I live. There are worse scenarios to be in. I'm very grateful to have been sent the wrong pevs there. And when this is all over, hopefully I'll be healthy enough to go to South East Lancashire and Manchester and look at those buildings.
It's an odd one. So, because one of the many weird ways in terms of, like, I haven't found any listed buildings, but like texts which have now become weirdly normal is like texting my partner the other day to go, "Great news! I've discovered another graveyard." Like, there's a bit.
The amount of time we spend in graveyards during this pandemic is really dark. Our daily walk is around the same graveyard. And it does feel like more graves are appearing, even though it's a Victorian graveyard. It's very bleak.
Stephen, I imagine your local is what, Abney Park?
My local is Abney Park, yes. Although I've discovered a thing that we'd believed for ages were like gardens behind one of the estates is actually just another, like, is like a Quaker cemetery.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, no, it's very nice. I mean, the one thing I would change is that there's like a very cute child of indeterminate gender and their dad who go out and play football as their like exercise thingy will be in the like green bit in the middle of our estate. And the child does like the world's most like elaborate goal celebrations.
Aww.
Despite the fact that, yeah, like it's one of those like, yeah, kind of like we'll properly like run to one corner of this quite small patch of grass and then like do the like looking at the skies, kissing of the fingers. And it's just like, it's one of those things where like the level of investment in the various goal celebrations, like I keep hoping that eventually the child will do the robot. It's very cheering.
Come up with a chant for the child. Semi appropriate.
On the very first day of lockdown, my friend suggested that we start a book club. So this group of friends, it originates with me and my best friend who were born in the same hospital in Belfast on the same day. And as we got older, we have friends from primary school and we added more at secondary school and we've added more people since we moved to London. So it's quite a quite big group of us. They're, you know, including some of my oldest friends and all very smart people, but not super literary, but as a sort of effort to read more and as a just sort of nice distraction. Some of them are doctors and having quite an intense time and others are teachers working with some poor kids in London who are, you know, the children of key workers and are still coming in. They just sort of wanted a nice distraction. So it's been really interesting. I mean, I could kind of extol the virtues of it, but there are also some definite downsides. One of my friends who's a lawyer picked Vile Bodies by Evelyn Waugh. I don't know if any of you have read it.
My book group is doing that at the moment.
Are you reading it at the moment?
Yeah, so I'm actually listening to it as an audiobook because...
That's an excellent move.
Well, so the problem I'm having with doing it as an audiobook and the problem I realise I have with audiobooks in general is that I'm really enjoying it, but I'm not sure if I'm enjoying it because I'm enjoying Vile Bodies or because I'm enjoying Robert Hardy reading Vile Bodies.
That is so interesting that you're reading it. So basically our book club concluded. So Harry was our friend who picked it. The first thing he said was that he thinks he enjoyed it because it was audiobook. And almost everyone else said that they didn't really massively enjoy it and they find it really difficult to follow. And everyone concluded that it was, you know, better as an audiobook. And it's a shame that they hadn't just performed it as a play right away. So I think it's interesting that you're enjoying it because I find it really hard going. For listeners who haven't read, it's by Evelyn Waugh in his sort of earlier period, published in 1930 in a similar style as Decline and Fall, sort of about the bright young things of the 1920s who just sort of party and do nothing. And it's a social satire. I find it really hard going and just sort of like the lack of character development, all kind of vacuous and annoying, even though I like Evelyn Waugh's other stuff. And there is something very, even though I did an English degree, I think there's something very weird about reading a book because you've been told to. And I think it's interesting that it was also your book club's choice, Stephen. I feel like in both cases it was maybe picked just because it's very short.
Yeah, how come you've both chosen that book?
So we have a voting system. We vote. I don't understand why it's really innovative. Oh, yeah.
oh God, this whole period is gradually destroying my cognitive function.
It was like watching a general election, right? In that horrifying moment when you realize the forces of conservatism are again going to be triumphant, right? Because at first, it's like, you know, like, at first, like, you know, like, girl, woman, other, which did come a strong third, like, you know, like books I actually wanted to, like, and it's one of those things where it's just like, happening.
Stephen, that's so funny because I proposed Girl, Woman, Other and it was voted down for being too long. So there are similar themes running through our book club choices.
Yeah, I guess everyone likes Brideshead Revisited or something. Although, yeah, I mean, this is the thing. So also, full disclosure, my book club is the Parliamentary Press Gallery's book club. So I feel like the influence of Evelyn Ward Scoop is probably what has triggered it's, to my mind, horrifying win.
I have a hipster favourite war, which is The Loved One, which is his novella, which is a satire on the Californian funeral home industry. It's very dark, very funny.
Mm, I haven't read that.
It's about 80 pages long, and it's sort of laugh out loud. He wrote as such like a grotesque satire on the California of the 30s and 40s. He thought no American could possibly like this book. But Americans, and it's like a satire on expat, you know, British expats in California. And he thought no American could possibly like this book. And then it was really popular in America. And it was adapted twice as a Hollywood film. And it's partly a satire on Hollywood. And he was so, so angry about it, which makes the experience of reading it all the better. There's a lovely line on the Wikipedia page, which is where I get most of my information, that said he was baffled and even angered by its success in America, which really tickles me. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Patrick McGuire, our political editor Stephen Bush, our Britain editor Anoush Jagelian, and my fellow political correspondent Alva Ray. The theme music is Devil by the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons, and it's produced by Nick Hilton.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.